It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosie.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosie.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosie. The show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes. And we have a blog, which you can check out at
filmsociology.tumblr.com.
The voice you heard is the man who did not watch the NFL schedule special because he has technology.
Yep.
That's Coby Slagle.
Hello.
Good to see you, sir.
Good to see you, too.
Have you recovered from post-drive exhaston? Is that a symptoms? PDE, post-drive exhaustion.
If you suffer from post-drive exhaustion, you may work in public radio.
Recovered a little bit. So, and we have company.
We do.
We have somebody who's always heard about this show, and it's almost like a mythical castle, and now she's in. Because I know her. We run in similar circles, and now she is her world has brought her to our world. She is the new promotions manager at Booth Tarkington Civic Theater. That's Indianapolis, Indy Civic Theater, whatever, way up in north. Anyway, Melissa Hook is in studio.
Hi.
And she is here because we are celebrating Spamalot.
Yes.
Which opens this weekend.
Yes.
This weekend. And Coby, later on, I have a CD in CD one, and it should be queued up.
Okay.
So we can celebrate Spamalot.
Production.
So good stuff. I know. You know what it is? You know what Elmore Leonard said this is? It's a real show.
It's terrific.
So good to have you here.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
All right. New in theaters. Ex Machina, which you can read Ed Johnson's review of it at Nouveau.net. Little Boy, which Nouveau is described as another Christ-centric short feature. I didn't write it. A Matter of Faith from, or as Nouveau calls it, God's Not Dead Redux. And Water Diviner from first-time director Russell Crowe, who also stars in it. Because if he didn't star in it, it wouldn't get financed. Are you all right over there?
I'm a little nervous about the Water Diviner.
Well, you don't have to, but it's over there. And and then, of course, the Jewish Film Festival is still going on, and we will trickle down to events that are happening, drive-ins and film festival series, and we have A Dead Person We Like, and we have Melissa. And in the second half of, the second two-thirds of the show, the two-thirds of the last two-thirds of the show, we'll replay my chat with actor, writer, director, producer James Keach. He is in town tonight at Clues Memorial Hall for the screening of Glenn Campbell, I'll Be Me. It was fun to have him. He'll be doing a Q&A as well as a live performance from a couple of the Campbell kids. So that's definitely worth checking out if you're en route as we speak. But opening in theaters today is and basically this is the period where we're just waiting for Avengers to have its screening, which is next week. Well, that's kind of it's the period between the end of Oscar season and when does the Avengers open, and so it's been
a very
defined space of time.
Oscars are over. When does the Avengers start? But we actually found something that I wound up surprisingly liking a lot more than I had anticipated, and it's called The Age of Adeline, and it stars Blake Lively. So Kobe, you're there. And it's what we critics were describing as it sounds like a lifestyle film, only it's better shot and better acted, and it's kind of better written. She plays a woman who, through a bizarre set of circumstances, car goes into the water, lightning strikes the water, and because of that, she has a special ability to never age. Because why would you want to age, Blake Lively? And so every 10 years, she has to change her name and her identity. And, of course, her own child keeps getting older and older and older.
And before you know it, she's Ellen Burstyn.
She is Ellen Burstyn. Her daughter grows up to become Ellen Burstyn, who's fun in this. She's got a nice bit as the daughter of Blake Lively. And we get to modern-day San Francisco, and she is starting to fall for a businessman played by Michael Huisman. Sorry if I'm saying that wrong. But she's starting to get feelings for the guy, but she's kind of torn because she has to keep changing her identity and her past
moving along.
So she's kind of – so that's the gist of it. And then we get into the second half of the film where supporting actors come off the bench, including Kathy Baker and Harrison Ford, who actually gives a damn in this film. Thank you, Mr. Ford.
Right?
I appreciate it.
It was not a phoned-in performance.
No, it was not. And we'll get to him in a little bit. So, Kobe, I think Fair Sweet Bianca is going to want to see this.
Well, I think she is, too, because
she's brought it up.
Well, no, she has not brought it up, but she was a big fan of the Gossip Girl TV series. And this, of course, stars
Blake
one
Lively.
Of the Gossip
but
Girls.
You don't care because it's just Blake Lively. And apparently, I think, Kobe, I believe Melissa can help you out with the situation because she likes somebody that's on your list. It's not a good list. And that person is involved with Ms. Lively. So you guys, I think you two need to team up and get a little, fantasy vigilanteism going on. So
yeah.
So I think it's a win-win, really. Frank will have a new cat sitter named Blake. That's what I was talking about, Bianca. Angry text in 3, 2... Oh, there it is. No, so and it is also being pushed a lot. Like it looks like a Nicholas Sparks novel, but it's not.
Yeah,
and it's not that sappy. And there's some eye rolling moments, but your eyeballs don't roll out of your head.
Right.
I think they handle the material well. Performances are good. Lively's fine. And it could veer in a couple different directions, and it doesn't. And because one thing we were talking about, and this is really isn't a spoiler, that we wondered if Peter Coyote and his government agents were going to show up, whether they're holding guns or walkie talkies, and throw that. It is alluded to a little bit at the very beginning about what happens when the government finds out there's a woman who can never age, and it goes.
Not that they know that that's exactly what's going on.
Right, they just know that she's something different about it. But she, anyway, that section goes away, and it's mostly about this family and this girl and this guy and what are they going to do about their situation. Mm-hmm. And
she has amazing hair and makeup and
always,
clothing.
In every decade ever, because she's Blake Lively.
After a couple of us saw the screening, my girlfriend and I, we were, chatting about it, and she's like, I loved her hair in every scene. And I said, and her makeup was flawless. And then we were like, and we want to buy all of her clothes. So
there's
something else that's a draw for the women.
I have to ask this because you are a young lady. And because I know there are certain actresses that your gender look upon with a feeling of disdain. past participants include Winona Ryder, Keira Knightley, Scarlett Johansson. Is Ms. Lively in the group photo on this, or do y'all like her?
I think that, well, I'll tell you, with this movie, she got some points to raise her up a bit. Okay. And I have to defend Winona Ryder because I'm older than you think I am, and Reality Bites is one of my all-time favorite movies.
I'm semi-smoother than that, but yes, you know what I was getting at.
No, I know, but I just mean that, you know.
But there was a period where I...
against Winona Ryder.
Okay, because there was a period where every female I brought that name up, and you would just kind of get disgusted Kermit face.
Wow, really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Winona Ryder had that.
Makes me kind of sad.
Don't worry about it. You're fine.
I could definitely see it with Scarlett Joho, though, for sure.
Yeah, well, no comment. Moving on. So anyway, performances are good, and it's not as sappy as you think it is, no matter what the ad campaign looks like. And, you know, if a guy likes this is the one that you can get dragged to. Because at the very least, you can look at Blake Lively, but it's not Nicholas Sparks. You don't need to feed it to diabetics when they go in the shock. It's actually a well done story with a little bit of fantasy that follows the rules and respects the rules of fantasy. This could have been really schmaltzy. It could have been really silly as far as what to do with this quote unquote gimmick. And I think the filmmakers handle it well. And it's from director Lee Tolan Krieger. Kobe, this is the guy that gave us Celeste and Jesse Forever. This was the guy that made us believe that if you're married to Adam Sandberg and
Rashida Jones.
Rashida Jones.
Remember, because they split
up, and if you're splitting up from Rashida Jones, you're an idiot.
Yeah.
So anyway, this is good. It's worth checking out.
It's also an art film.
No, it's not an art film. It's opening nationwide, but it's good. It's good. Okay, now going back to Harrison Ford. His character, he plays the father of the boyfriend,
interest,
of the love interest. And there's a big major plot point.
Whoa.
Yeah, I know. major plot thing. We like to say here, we do use technical jargon here at Film Sociology, like plot things. Character things. There's a major plot character thing involving Mr. Ford's character. It's even better when they're combined. And... But Ford, it happens with Ford's character, and if you really, really think about the logistics of his character and his son, not once did I go, ew. And I think that's a good sign of a film.
I do too. Yeah.
And so I was going back, and I was trying to remember, with the exception of 42, I was trying to remember, when was the last it looked like Harrison Ford actually cared about a film he was involved in? I went through his IMDb list with another guy, with my buddy Kyle, and for us, it went all the way back to Air Force One.
Wow.
That's 1997, I believe. So, yeah, not good. Anyway, good to see. And I'm sure he'll care about Star Wars because he's getting a big pat check. So that's worth checking out. What's new on DVD and Blu-ray this week? Taken 3, which is actually The Fugitive. Didn't need that. Everly, which is an action film with Salma Hayek. Not fun. And Cake, which was apparently Jennifer Aniston's attempt to win a Best Actress nomination. She didn't get it. It's a good film. It's not top five material.
She'll have another chance.
And Escape from New York is on Blu-ray, as well as Coolie High. And if you need both of these on a single Blu-ray, Break In and Break Into Electric Boogaloo.
Ooh,
there's that.
I do need that.
So, Melissa, tell us about... Do you really?
I think I do.
Oh, my gosh. And you were making fun of Xanadu earlier. So Spamalot is opening tonight, actually, at the theater. How are things going over there?
Wonderfully. Thank you for asking.
Mm-hmm.
We're very excited. It's going to be going on from between now and May 9th.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great show.
You've seen it before.
I have seen it. I saw it on Broadway.
Ooh.
And...
She saw it with David and Tim and Hank.
Anyway.
Cool.
I'm not, like, you know, name dropping stuff.
I did it for you.
I'm just saying.
She's also a ventriloquist.
Right. That's true. No, but our production is wonderful. These actors and actresses are phenomenal. They're funny. They're great. And it's silly and it's chaotic, but in a good way. And if you're a fan of Monty Python...
It's a complete geek fest.
You will totally love it.
And if you're not a fan of Python, you still dig the music. It's a lot of fun. Civic's got a rock solid reputation when it comes to musical theater, of course.
Thank you. Yes.
And yes, big shout out to Brent E. Marty.
Oh my gosh, isn't that amazing?
Isn't he?
He is amazing.
He got a creative fellowship in
Arts
Creative Fellowship.
The Arts Council.
Yes, class of 92 at the Ball State University. Hi, Brent. Because if I don't mention him, I get angry emails from him. So.
Hi, Brent.
What is so that is running through May 9th. And for ticket information, people can go to?
They can go to civictheater.org/spamalot.
Cool.
They can call 317-843-3800.
Mm-hmm.
They can email me if they want to. They can stop by and visit.
You really
Melissa
wanna
at civictheater.org.
Oh, that's your work email. That's good.
Well, yeah.
that's safe.
I mean, you know.
Right. And tell us the rest of the season.
Well, this is our finale. For this season.
I mean, I meant the announcement
centennial.
For next season.
Yes, just today.
This is
we announced,
season announcement
drum
time.
Drum roll, please. I started to say we're going to get, like, in the midst of all the other theaters and everything announcing. But we're very excited about our 2015-2016 season. Kicks off with Little Women the Musical on September 11th. And then we've got The Games Afoot. We've got our holiday spectacular, Mary Poppins. Doubt a Parable. Yes, it is like the movie.
Not the musical.
It's not a musical.
Not a musical,
but it is from the movie that Philip Seymour Hoffman was in. Fiddler on the Roof.
Cool.
And something new to the season that's we're going to keep this a little bit under wraps. We're just going to kind of tease this right now, is a concert. So it's going to be a musical soundtrack, so to speak, but it's in the form of a concert, so it's something a little different.
It's Abdul on stage. Okay, with that in mind, let's shift gears and let's go back. This is my chat with James Keach. The film that he directed, I'll Be Me, is playing at Clues Memorial Hall tonight. Here's my chat with James. So James, why are you in Indianapolis besides promoting the film?
Indianapolis, we're in Indianapolis promoting the film to meet with Eli Lilly about potential sponsorship for the film throughout the world.
I'm really glad you made the film. It's really well done. Really enjoyed it, and it gives a warts and all look of what Glenn has had to go through. When did you start filming, and how long did it take?
We started filming in the summer of 2011, thinking it was going to be a 5.5 week tour, it turned out to be in a two and a half year shoot, 151 shows. The reason being is when Glenn first came out and said that he had Alzheimer's and that he was going to go out and tour, he had very few bookings, and I think most people were very fearful that this was going to be a train wreck. And as soon as the audiences saw it, they realized that this was one of the most inspiring things that anybody had ever seen. And the bookings just continued to grow. And so did the reviews. The reviews were very, very positive. And that's how it ended to be 2.5 years. So I should say that we thought that we would be only doing it for 5.5 weeks, and we're kind of relieved at the thought of doing it, because we couldn't figure out a way to make a show that was going to be uplifting and positive about a guy with Alzheimer's. The producer of his last two albums was a very good friend of mine, and he kept saying, "Come on, James, you've been shooting rock shows for a while. You have all the equipment. Come on, just do it. Just record it for history." Well, we did record it for history, but it also, in doing that, changed our life, changed my life personally, completely, actually. As a filmmaker and as a guy who was very, very much afraid of what Alzheimer's is and what it might do to somebody, to being an advocate for really wanting to change the conversation about it and to really inform the world as to what we're up against and to let people see what a hero Glenn Campbell is.
Now, you said the producer, record producer, was that how you got involved with the project?
Julian Raymond. Mm-hmm. Julian Raymond who produced Glenn Campbell, I'll Be Me, and Ghost on a Canvas. Was producing my son Johnny, who was 13 at the time, was producing his music and kept coming into the studio and saying, "Come on, man, you got to meet Glenn," because I'd made a movie a few years before called Walk the Line.
Yep.
And produced it, and he said, "You know, we got to do something about Glenn before it's too late." And I didn't know what too late was in the early parts of our conversation. Too late, of course, turned out to be Alzheimer's. And I said to Julian and my partner Trevor Albert, we both said to him, look, we made that movie. We did the biopic, and it's not that Glenn's not an incredible story. It's just that you kind of want to try and work on other kinds of pictures, you know. And you got to meet him. You got to meet him. This went on for 6 months. Finally, he said, he's going to tell the world he's got Alzheimer's. He's going to do a very short tour. Will you meet him, please? So we said, sure, we'll meet him. And Glenn, when he came over, by the way, over the weekend beforehand, we watched everything we could about Alzheimer's. And everything we saw was so, so depressing. It always showed people at the end stages of it, or the scientific version of it. Except The Notebook, which was a beautiful, beautiful film, I thought. Mm-hmm. But it didn't. There weren't documentaries that showed it. And then we met Glenn. Glenn comes into the house, and he's with his beautiful wife Kim, and Johnny's walking across the living room, and has his guitar in his hand, and he goes, "Hey, I play guitar," and Johnny goes, "Yes, sir, I know you play guitar." He says, "You want me to show you something?" And Johnny says, "Sure." And he picks up the guitar and he just shreds it. And he said, "That's what Uncle Boo taught me. You practice that, you'll be good." And then Johnny walked into his bedroom and took his guitar, and Glenn looked at Kim and he said, "You know what? A man findeth a good woman, he findeth a good thing. I found me a good thing. That's my thing." And he's talking to Kim, and she said, and then Kim said to me, "James, you know, Glenn's got Alzheimer's, and we want you to film this." And he says, "What? I got what?" He said, "You got Alzheimer's." He says, "No, I don't. I got part-timers." So you got it right up front. Here was the guy who's in love with his wife, who's an incredible musician, who wasn't afraid to talk about what was going on in his life. Oh, and here comes Johnny walking back across the living room. And Glenn looks over at him and says, "Hey, I play guitar. You want me to show you something?" So we got to see the whole thing right there, like in a period of 5 minutes.
A natural pitch.
And it was just like, wow, this guy is so, he's funny, he's self-deprecating, he's engaging, he's, and that's what he is in the film. And so just felt that, 5 weeks, that's what Kim says, it's only 5 weeks, it's going to be 5 weeks, okay. And so here we are 4 years later, I'm still talking about it. And the film is just now beginning its journey out into the world. That we were in 80 cities and did probably, I don't know, it's the best reviewed film I've ever made. And if you could imagine a song in the movie called "I'm Not Gonna Miss You," and it's the last song, was nominated for an Academy Award. Now, if you can imagine a guy 76 years old with Alzheimer's nominated for an Academy Award, and 3 Grammys, and the broadcast critics thing. And I mean, it's just like, who would have ever thought? That's not why we got into it. What I'm saying is that when Glenn Campbell said, "I ain't done yet," and he was told to hang up his guitar, and here's a guy that, we all, given some terrible diagnosis of whatever, Alzheimer's, cancer, heart disease, whatever, a lot of us just go, "Okay, poor me," and go sit on the pity pot, and that's the end of it. Instead, he said, "Nope, I'm going to keep playing until I can't play anymore." And in so doing, what he's doing is he's showing the world a way to the Alzheimer's. He's showing the world a way to live, and his family, the caregiving. It's a beautiful, beautiful tribute to a family. And for me, as a film, I don't know.
You got it.
Yeah, I got to do it.
Yeah.
Which is 1,400 hours of film I got to got to do it.
Yeah. So you had not met him before this?
No, I didn't. I had not. They knew of me because of John Cash, and they knew people obviously that knew John Cash, and John Cash was a dear friend of my wife's and mine, and was the godfather of my kids, and he asked me to make that movie. So,
well, I'd say the amount of footage, and I know you said you shot 1,400, but the amount of footage, warts and all, ups and downs, I wondered if you had known him, because the amount of the access that you were able to get, backstage, at home. So the fact that you didn't, I think that's something to be said about you as a filmmaker, as well as capturing it with the camera.
Well, I think it is something to be said about me as a filmmaker, maybe as a person. I love to talk to people. I like asking questions more than I like talking about, myself. I like sharing stories of people's lives. I'm very interested in where people come from. And Glenn and I and John Cash, we all shared one similar thing, and that is I didn't have to. All my friends when I was growing up, a little small town in Texas, they picked cotton because that's what they had to do. And I picked cotton because they did, and I wanted to go do it. So I always knew where they came from. These guys, from the cotton fields and struggles with substances there was always an honesty about our conversations. And I think when I said to the family, I said, "Look, I'm not going to put anything in this film that I wouldn't say about my own dad." And, after a period of time, at first people were reluctant. All the people on the crew, they'd look at you and they'd go, "Who is this guy?" And then, you spend enough time with somebody and you get to know their character. And that's the interesting thing about, for me, going from narrative film to documentary film, is that in narrative film you write the script. And, of course, the actors, when they're really... the performances are great. They trust you like the families do in the documentaries. They start trusting when you see something nuance that, you say, that's really good, but maybe let's try it a little different. And they trust that you're not trying to manipulate them into something that you want to see. If you're really good, they're trusting that you want to bring the best out in them, which is a big difference, mm-hmm. And I think the Campbells, they wanted to tell the true story, but they also, dignity was something very important, and I was there to help take care of Glenn. Trevor and I, we became part of the caregiving group. We would take Glenn when he was having a problem or he was lost somewhere. We'd go find him, and we were there all the time. So it became a very different experience, and that's what I mean because I've become an advocate. I now understand what caregiving is about, mm-hmm. and the role of the caregiver and how this is just, it's so important that people understand this. And we did a screening in Nashville for 4,000 people at one time, and then we did a concert afterwards. And I was the MC of the show, and the band Perry was playing, and Ashley Campbell and Delta Ray. There was the three bands that were playing after the screening. And the time of setting up, I said to the audience, "How many people in this audience? I'm just curious. How many people have been touched by Alzheimer's, or caregiving, or somebody who knows?" And 4,000 people stood up. And I went, "And how many of you actually talked to other people about it?" And almost all of them sat down. Because there's a whole shame connected with it. There's a whole, embarrassment. There's the, and that's what Glenn's doing. He's showing us, you don't have to hide. We don't have to. We can understand. We can have compassion for people who have this. And one of the things that was so moving and important to me in as a human being in making the film and really reinforced my faith in humanity was that the audience. When he would play, instead of being judgmental, and when he would forget a line or something like that, they cheered him on.
Mm-hmm.
They gave him standing ovation after standing ovation for his courage. And I will say that in between, when he messed something up and then he'd get it back, and when he'd get it back, he'd get it back in spades. He'd just kill it. I mean, he's still a genius musician. But it was still that spirit of And that's why it was, seeing the show was so cool, because it was like an experience. It was you don't know what's going to happen next. It's like a movie where you sit on the edge of your seat and you don't know what's going to happen. Is the teleprompter going to break down? Mm-hmm. Or is he going to play in the wrong key, which he did some nights? And the kids they learned how to really be good musicians, because he would play, he'd start in the wrong key and he would not come out of it. And so now they had to switch.
They had to adjust.
Exactly. So.
Well, it's funny you mentioned, because
you know, Glenn did a show in Carmel, which is just north of here, and I think it was a couple of weeks before it became known, before he went public with Alzheimer's. And, of course, the reviews were saying that the performance was erratic and, you know, he'd start, he'd repeat. So, you know, obviously a couple of weeks later, we finally got the explanation as to why. But, yeah, you like you said, watching the show, because I remember this, I think there's a part where his wife says, you know, here's your teleprompter, here's your mark. And as an audience member, when you would see him veer right or veer left, you kind of tense up a little bit and like, oh, I hope he's all right. Hope he makes it. And yeah, and you were able to show sometimes he did and sometimes he didn't.
Right. That makes for good drama, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
That's right. That's one of the things that was so exciting about it. And I was always on stage right. I had his close-up camera. So that was the other thing about, you know, going from there. Usually, you know, you have Conrad Hall shooting the movie when you're making, you know, something like that. Instead, it's James Keach, and the other guys were all shooting cameras, and it was really exciting, you know. And one night, Glenn at Carnegie Hall, he walked over to me, and he walked right into this giant close-up, and he goes, "Hey, like a rhinestone cowboy," and he puts the mic right in my mouth. And he wants me to sing it with me, and I said, "Stop it, stop that." You know, and I had to do it. I did it in the audience chair. But it was fun.
I was wondering, you mentioned how often did he notice the camera whether it was in studio or at home?
He would notice it sometimes. He liked it. You know, he's one of those guys. It's probably like you with that microphone. You like having it in front of you. You feel good because this is your world.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn's world was being on that stage, and he liked, he wanted to make the movie. He wanted us to be around. And he'd forget it. He'd forget that we were there. When one of the most moving moments for me filming was at the Mayo Clinic, and they would only allow one camera in. And that was me, mm-hmm. And they're injecting him with dye to do a PET scan of his brain, and he's there, and he wondered where I was right at the beginning. Then he forgot I was even there because I set up two cameras and I let one roll for a wide shot over here, and I had a close up camera straight on him, and I was pretty far back. Because I like to use longer lenses. I didn't ever want to get too close to him because I didn't want him to be conscious of me being there. And he just starts singing to Kim, and they go into their own world. And he trusted me as a person, so he always knew that if I was in the room, everything was okay. Somehow that if I was nearby, that he kept him calm. So the camera became a friend to him, his friend.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he noticed the camera. He never played to it. He certainly never ever did things for the camera for performance.
And I also wondered if depending on what day he had, of him wondering what are these people doing in my house because of the Alzheimer's. That never happened?
Well, a lot of times what we would do with the cameras there is we would set them up and we'd walk away.
Okay.
Yeah, or Kim would set them up and walk away,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it was just there. And then we would go through the footage.
You mentioned how funny he is, and I think a lot of people forget that. I mean, the guy had a variety show at one time, so we know the musicality. But, yeah, seeing him working with his family, especially with his family on the road, and yeah, even talking with doctors, he's just a sunlight.
He is. He you know, he said it in the film, "I've laughed and I've cried. It's a hell of a lot better to laugh." And he loved Roger Miller, and he would always tell jokes. He always wanted you to smile, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he still does like people. You go visit with Glenn now, and you don't know what he's laughing about, but he's laughing about something, and he starts laughing so hard that he gets everybody else laughing. You know,
mm-hmm.
he's just an amazing, special, honest guy. That's the other thing that he would say things in his Alzheimer's repetitiveness that were very important to him. Like, when a man findeth a good woman, talk about Kim. He has very deep belief, very deep faith, and he would also always talk about the importance of telling the truth. You know, and how about how lying's no good, and then he would talk about drugs. And if there was ever an anti-drug guy, it was him, about how it really messed his life up for a short period of time. But that short period of time, you know, was magnified into a, you know, a real media thing. And I think the alcohol thing was, I think the alcohol was to self-medicate his, the beginnings of his Alzheimer's, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all this stuff, all the drugs and substance abuse and everything, it's to deal with the pain that comes from so far back in all our lives, you know, and we're trying to self-medicate the pain. I think that's just my opinion. You know, when Glenn would talk about his growing up and how tough it was where he came from, and the same thing with John Cash, it was tough, man.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure for many, many people in this country, it's really tough.
Now, not really giving away anything, but we do get to see the final concert, and I know the tour was hit. I mean, they ended the tour on the right note. I guess it was
Napa,
right? And I guess it was best to finish it here, and get out while the getting is good. I guess was that your original intent, or was that their original intent? It was just covering the tour, and then that's it.
The original intent, first of all, the original intent was 5.5 weeks.
Right, well, yes.
So 2.5 years later, you know, millions of dollars later, oh my gosh, you know, and maybe someday we'll get it back. But that's not the important thing. The important thing is that the world see the film. And I think for your audience that I can promise them that they will be uplifted. And it's funny. There's more big laughs in this movie than there are in major comedies. I mean, it's funny. He is so funny. Your question is that the intent to end it here? That was the last book show of that year. And we all felt that Glenn wasn't enjoying it as much. It was agitating him.
Mm.
And yet the night before that show might have been his best show. That's the thing that's so amazing about this thing. And he was still good that night. He's still, you know, Southern Nights, the song he ends with is beautiful. And it's just that, you know, he wasn't enjoying it as much, and it was getting him agitated and stressed out and disoriented. So the whole idea was not to do the show because we had to do the show, because there was a need to make money or anything. It was to prolong Glenn's health. That's ultimately the idea, is to give him the opportunity to do what he loves the most. Because we believe, and I think the doctors that have seen the film since subsequently, that this really prolonged his journey as a musician and as a human being, because soon after we stopped, even though the last song was done several months later, I filmed that several months later with the Wrecking Crew, he went downhill pretty fast after the tour was over. I mean, we'd go and play little clubs here and there. We'd bring musicians over. One night we went to see Merle Haggard and Toby Keith was there, and we went out into the bus and played, which is really cool. And he could still just kill it, you know. But, you know, I don't know. Alzheimer's is a tricky thing, man. It breaks your heart. It breaks your heart it breaks the hearts of the people that are around the people more than it breaks the hearts of the people that are suffering from it, at least in the end stages.
Mm-hmm.
In the beginning stages, when you know you have it and you're facing it, you know, it's not easy.
Well, and shifting gears a little bit, congratulations on the film getting a nomination for the song. I know will you be at the Oscars?
I hope so, yeah, I will. I will. I'm a member of the Academy, so I'll be there. But it got nominated for 3 Grammys, too.
Yes, congrats on that as well.
Which I just think is, you know, you got nominated for Best Video. for the Country Music Association. So, you know, I am not a spring chicken. So, and this is my first music video. So it's never too late. It's never too late. You can go out there and make your music video. I tell you right now.
Well, I'm not going to ask your age, but I do love directors with a 6, a 7, and an 8 in their age still making work. Still, I mean, I play jazz and blues musicians that are in their 90s, still putting out product, still putting out work.
It's good, man.
Absolutely,
hey, man. You know, I mean, listen. Look at Clint. I did a movie with Clint with Robert Duvall.
Stars Fall on Henrietta.
Yeah, right. And I'll never forget Clint. I said, "Do you have one note for me, Clint?" He said, "Yeah. If you got the shot, move the camera." Meaning, don't do the same take twice, which is really interesting because he's so sparse, you know, in what he does. And here's the absurdity of the Academy. Here's a guy. This is maybe his best film in many, many, many years, and he's not nominated. You know, I mean, come on, guys. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, there's such politics in all these organizations. You know, if you're not a member of the Doc branch, you're not a member of the Little Club. You know, you're a member of the Narrative branch. You know, it's if you're not a member of the Narrative branch, you know, and you're a member of the Doc branch, it's just, you know, it's human nature. You know, we're all in our little cliques, and mm-hmm. you know, but Clint's work is remarkable.
Two films in 1 year.
Yeah. And one of which I did not care for at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered, what the heck did you do that for? You know, and although there was some good stuff in it, but I guess he did it because he wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And that he loved that period of music because he loves music.
Yep.
You know, and it wasn't a bad film. I mean, well, I like the play better. How's that?
Sure. That's all right.
I enjoyed the play more. But, you know, for those people who never knew who those guys were, the Jersey Boys, and the kids that are growing up, your kids, my kids.
It's a good 101.
Yeah, it is. It's a good thing for them to see, and it'll live, and it'll be fine. So, but that, compared to American Sniper, my God.
Mm-hmm. And I think he's been able to, I mean, you know, he retired the tough guy. He retired his Western persona with Unforgiven. He retired his tough guy persona with Gran Torino, and he's been able to direct anything he wants, whether it's Jersey Boys or American Sniper or Bridges of Madison County or Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. You know, to be able to direct what you want and have a studio backing you on that, that's rare.
Yeah, you got to be named Clint Eastwood.
Now, you said you'd filmed concert footage before. Who else have you shot?
I went out with Cheap Trick.
Yeah?
Yeah, Johnny, the kid, opened for Cheap Trick for a few, for 2 years, so that's what we were doing. Cool. It was fun.
Between your film and Still Alice, there is a lot, you know, people are talking more about Alzheimer's. I've even approached by a lot of people, whether it's on the street or at festivals. You know, you mentioned the Nashville event. Has that become almost a daily occurrence now?
We have requests for around 300 screenings. And it's just going to grow exponentially, I think. And, you know, we were reading yesterday in China, the number is staggering, how many people have it. So I think the long tail of this movie is going to be great. And I think, too, that the thing that's exceptional about it is that there's music in it. It makes it so palpable. Because, you know, you get to see a guy play his music, and it's good music. And the Still Alice movie and Julianne Moore's performance is really good. There's no question about it. There's not a lot of laughs, and it's a narrative linear progression from you got it to you're out of it. And Glenn is the difference, of course, is one is real and one is imagined. Mm-hmm. And I think we screened it here, actually, at Lilly a few weeks ago. And the head of their Japanese global marketing division saw it, and she wants to take it to Japan, and so take it to Australia, and it's a huge problem in China. And the thing that's cool about it is that it's a very entertaining film. So if you can entertain people, inform them, empower them, inspire them, get them to want to make a change, we got a shot at slowing this sucker down, because we need everybody to – we need financial support to do it, you know. And I think that most people have perceived this as being an old person's thing, and it's not. The people that are going to suffer the most from it are the young people, because they're going to have to take care of the old people. It's going to break the economy, which is a frightening thing, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, just to talk realistically, 2050, it'll exceed the national – 2025, it'll exceed the national defense budget. 2050, you'll start breaking the economy.
Mm-hmm. You said it took 2.5 years. What did you do in between? I mean, did you have pockets of time where you were able to work on other projects, or were
not
you just
really.
Kind of on standby?
No, not really. This has been my life for a while.
Well, it's not just Steve James who has the multi-year commitments when it comes to making documentaries. You are now a part of that club. So
yeah.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
If I may, I want to shift gears a little bit. I want to personally thank you for creating The Long Riders.
Ah, good.
I got to see that with my dad when it came out. Where did that start? Where did telling the story of the James family come about for you?
My brother and I did a movie called Orville and Wilbur.
Yep.
We played the Wright brothers. And so we thought, let's play the wrong brothers. So Stacy and I, you know, he at the time, he's 7 years older, and at the time he was just starting to really ascend as a movie star. And I went off and I was into music, and I said, we'll try and write it as a country western musical. We did it as the Bandit Kings, and so we made a musical about the James Gang. I just thought it would be cool because it was the time Keith was doing Hair and Keith Carradine, and, mm-hmm. and you know, there was a lot of musicals being done, and Godspell, and it was a cool time in the theater in New York, and so we started to do that, and then.
But I'm sorry, but when he says the James Gang, he doesn't mean the group with Joe Walsh. That's another group.
Yeah, this is the Jesse James
the
Gang.
The actual Jesse James
Gang. Jesse James, Cole Younger, you know, the Miller Brothers, yeah. So we did it for a while, and we played it at the Bowery Lane Theater, and it was fun. And then we said, let's try and develop it into a movie. So we took the script and wrote the script, and then I was doing a film in Bora Bora with Tim Zinnemann, and Tim Zinnemann had done a movie with Walter Hill, and he said, what are you working on all the time? And I said, I'm working on this. And he said, let me read it. And he said, you know who'd like this is Walter Hill. And so he said, can you get all those guys? And I said, I don't know. Yeah, I think we can. So Keith was doing an album, and so we went to the record plant. It's burned down now, the record plant in Hollywood, and we got the Bridges brothers, the Carradine brothers, the Keats brothers, and we all went out into the alley. It was like 2 a.m, and we took a picture of all of us together, and we sent it to them, and that began the journey. The Bridges brothers eventually weren't able to do it, and it became the Guest brothers, Chris and Nick Guest. And the Quaids.
And
the Quaids were in the picture too, Randy and Dennis Quaid. So, yeah. So that original script, we wrote the original script, and Walter came in and did a rewrite on the script. We did a rewrite on that script, and then we went and we made it, and it was awesome.
Where'd you shoot it?
We shot it in Clayton, Georgia, Albany, Georgia, Texas, and Sonora, California, where they had the trains. We did single gauge trains.
Besides the brothers casting, which I think is a great marketing tool, not a gimmick, but I also read that Walter Hill and wanted to have a family feel on the film, and obviously that paid off not only with your brothers, but the film also humanizes these characters that we kind of grew up knowing as being notorious bad guys, and then seeing them at home chopping wood, dealing with the women in their lives. You know, that seemed more interesting than just black hats versus white hats.
Well, that's what it was. You know, it was like, you know, when Jesse's mother was and his brother was tortured, and they were, you know, you understood why they did what they did. You know, why they were so upset about everything, and why, you know, they went after the Pinkertons. One of the things about wars that we don't understand is we see all the people running down the streets, you know, the Iranians, the Iraqis. We don't have compassion for the fact that they, you know, those kids are born and they're nurtured and they're loved and they're, you know, we dehumanize them in some way, and which is sad. And in this case, the James gang, this was a family, and they were wronged. In my opinion, they were wronged by the North. They were, you know, and they took it upon themselves, rightly or wrongly, to seek revenge for it. You know.
Now, how was it working with Walter Hill as a director, and did he later influence you as a director?
I love Walter. Walter, here's Walter. I love telling this story. I can tell it now, years later. So we're out in front of a Corkindale barn, and there's a big shootout. And on the, you know, in those days, they probably still do, the barn, they would squib the barn. They put squibs, they put M13s or whatever things in the barn. And they would blow holes in it to appear as if bullet holes were coming through, so that you get, and then they'd backlight it so that the light would come flashing through and you'd see all these holes in the barn. So I'm out there with a rifle, and I'm shooting in front of the barn, and there's this whole thing going on, you know, big raid, and about three of these M13s blow up, and they hit me in the back, and it blows holes literally in my back, you know, and blood, and my knees buckle, because I'm just,
right,
not like I can't hold myself up, I've been hit, and I'm going down on the ground, and I'm shooting, it's in slow motion, and it's cool, and I hear Walter go, "God, God, God, Keith, damn it. If you ever do that again, I'll bullwhip you." I said, "What are you talking about? They're carrying me off to the hospital." He said, "You can't fall down like that. You're Jesse James." Walter, you know, I had stitches in my back and everything. He was funny. He always appeared to be a tough guy. He was John Ford's second assistant director. So, you know, and John
he survived Peckinpah as well.
Right, he survived Peckinpah, and he liked to wear the eye patch and all that stuff, you know. And but he's a terrific filmmaker and a good guy. And, you know, he liked making those tough guy movies. He was good at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It also makes me want to have Ry Cooter provide the soundtrack of my life.
Ry Cooter's pretty darn good.
Pretty good.
Pretty darn good.
Not bad at all.
Not bad at all.
So, as you said, you're 7 years younger than Stacey. What's it like to direct your brother?
Well, now he asks me to direct him in lots of movies. For many years, he was like, "Hey, kid, you know." So now I think he figures I've proved myself as a filmmaker. But it's actually his... He was directing. The reason I wanted to become a director was because of him. He was doing a movie, down in Alabama, about an Alabama prison, and he was doing a little documentary. And I came into the editing room and I would watch him cut it, and it was just so fascinating to me how films were put together. I loved it, so I really fell in love with the whole idea of it. And I still am in love with it. It's still magic to me.
Mm-hmm.
Still 90 minutes in the dark is magic. Going to the movies and making movies is it's the coolest thing you can do.
What are you working on next?
You know, it's interesting. We've developed a lot of narrative scripts, but I am leaning towards making documentaries. During the period of this film, because of the caregiver and all the stuff that caregivers go through, we started talking to people who've been connected with the military with post-traumatic stress syndrome. And it's fascinating to talk to them about the moral injury that takes place when you have to do things like in war that you shouldn't do, that goes against your conscience, and caregiving, and when you're dealing with people with health, the problems that you have. So there's something very interesting to me about that moral injury thing that takes place in all of us that causes addiction, that causes pain, that causes. So I'm kind of intrigued to look at that area and to try and find, to make a movie kind of like Glenn's movie that's inspirational, but that will allow people to see and to have empathy for people who have to, like soldiers who do things like this and what they go through and how we can help them, and people who are caregivers, how we can help them and how we can help ourselves, heal ourselves. So I suppose that's something that's an area that I'm interested in. And I don't know, I think there's a lot to be said about it, and I think there's not a lot said about it.
And now that you have a title of director of an Academy Award nominated documentary, that will hopefully get a little more incentive.
I don't know. I hope so.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
And that was my chat with filmmaker James Keach. And if you don't have plans, you still have some time, but you can go check out I'll Be Me at Clues Memorial Hall. All right, Kobe,
yep.
Quickly, we should go through the list at the IMA. They announced everybody's announcing their seasons this week, as Melissa did for Civic. What is happening at the IMA this summer?
All right, starting June 5th, National Lampoon's Vacation. June 12th, The Heathers.
What?
Yep.
They wrote the?
No, they didn't write the, but
you're just being an old person.
Heathers.
Like, it's Heathers.
The Heathers. Then on June 19th, Heather? It's going to be the Casablanca.
Well, stop putting the. You're not that old. Stop putting the in titles.
June 26th, The Psycho.
Will you stop? It's also
July 3rd, The Jaws. July 10th, Flash Gordon. July 17th, Shaun of the Dead. July 24th, Elf. July 31st, Major League, and then the final four from our
tournament,
from the bracket here. August 7th, Singing in the Rain. August 14th, Big Lebowski. August 21st, Shining. August 28th, Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Okay, what's funny about that is The Shining really is The Shining.
Yes, it is.
And you omitted the.
He's that type of person. Well, very good. Congrats to the IMA for that. Happening at the Tibbs Drive-In. We have Paul Blart 2 and Get Hard. Then we have Cinderella and Home, Unfriended and Furious 7. And then here you go, Age of Adeline and Longest Ride.
Ugh.
Do we have that?
I would rather see Age of Adeline and Furious 7 together, I think.
You're going to sneak out. And then over at the drive-in over at the Skyline Theater in Shelbyville, you can check out Cinderella, The Duff, and their Saturday Night Late movie from 1976, The Electric Chair. So they do. They like to do two new ones, and then to do an old school drive-in one. And I need to raise my hat and tip my hat and raise my glass, or tip my glass and raise my hat to Time Magazine critic Richard Corliss, that died this week at the age of 71. He was the one who was not Richard Sheckel, but a fine writer, really. And if you should look at his stuff. Time Magazine is still one of the best publications as far as not just journalism, but film criticism. And when you have two guys of that caliber working for the same publication, that's pretty good. So, Kobe, do we have stuff? Do we have time for IU Cinema?
Yes, we do. Tonight, 7 o'clock, Friday, April 24th, from 1973, Lucky Luciano.
Okay.
Saturday, the 25th at 7 o'clock, Three Brothers. And then Sunday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, The Gods Must Be Crazy,
ooh,
followed by Whatever Comes Next at 6:30.
The title is called Whatever Comes
Whatever Comes Next,
you
yes.
You are just being flippant.
No, and then Glenn Close is going to be there Monday, but that is sold out.
So you'll have to go see the Avengers then.
Yeah.
Well, that's next. It's next week, right?
Yeah, that's
so
Monday.
So, ladies and gentlemen, there are plenty to see before the Avengers arrives. Go to Spamalot. And then you can go down to the drive-in. I know that's just what everybody's waiting for, the Avengers. That's all there is to it. And
Spamalot is really funny.
And Spamalot is really
it's
funny.
It's definitely worth seeing.
Yes, it's been enough time that I've since the last time I saw it, need to check it out again. So,
cool.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's you have a weekend. Make the most of it. So, due diligence. Do we have words to live by?
Silent breed is people! Zardoz has spoken.
You've only got 1 weekend before the event.
So
make it count.
Make it count. Make it so. Melissa Hook from Civ, thank you so much for hanging out.
Thank you for having me.
We'll bring you back in when we have a full show.
Yeah.
So we have
that.
A full hour. I know, because I know you can
That'd be
gab.
Terrific.
You can gab. It is a real show. It's terrific. You're quoting Amore Leonard. Go see a good movie or go see Spamalot and do something before the Avengers because you deserve it. You're listening to the Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. I'm going to go check out the Lions schedule.
We go. Good night, Fort Myers. Good night, California.